Well, good morning. We're glad to be together again this morning after not having class quite as many times over the last week and a half, but we had a lot of other good stuff. But we need to get back into our study of the epistles. Looking forward to that as we're in 1 Peter chapters 4 and 5 this morning. And these two chapters are fairly short chapters, but they're extraordinarily rich. And again, we'll, as usual, kind of have to be pressed for time to say even half of what we'd like to say about them, but hopefully we can glean some of the big points, the big rocks, as we're saying, from our study this morning. As we review the theme and purpose of 1 Peter, we're to rejoice to the extent that we partake of Christ's sufferings, Peter says. So a central theme in this epistle is that suffering for Christ is a privilege and a blessing, and it's really part of what it means to be Christ-like. And I think that's maybe the biggest takeaway from the whole book. Our pilgrimage is full of hardship, but it will lead us to stronger faith, holier lives, fuller submission, a greater longing for our home in heaven. So coupled with that, or maybe quadrupled with that, you have suffering going along with some other really important concepts that are connected with it. Sanctification, this is the appropriate condition for someone who's not of this world, and he's going to suffer because he's sanctified, and he's going to be sanctified because he suffers. We'll look at some of that today. Submission, this is a needed characteristic of every pilgrim. We're going to submit ourselves to God, and when we do that, again, there's going to be suffering involved in that. And salvation, we suffer for salvation, we suffer because of salvation. All of those things are interconnected, and several of them are connected with one another as we go through. So let's look at 1 Peter chapter 4. It's really starting out right again on that theme. Every chapter talks about this, the concept of suffering. Therefore, since Christ suffered for us in the flesh, arm yourselves also with the same mind, for he who has suffered in the flesh has ceased from sin, that he no longer should live the rest of his time in the flesh for the lusts of men, but for the will of God. So as pilgrims, we want to be Christ-like. We're traveling through this world to be as he is, to become true Christian. And that is, as we've already said, it is a privilege and a blessing to do that. We arm ourselves with this Christ-like mind of self-sacrificial suffering. Those who have suffered and died with Christ will not readily choose to go back into the world, both in a physical sense and in a spiritual sense. Christians align themselves with the suffering of Christ. And there's a bit of a double meaning here as you think about that in these first couple of verses of 1 Peter 4. So when we become Christians, what did Jesus say to do to become a disciple of his? Take up your cross and follow me. And a cross is an instrument of death. And so we suffer in the cross, spiritually speaking. And in baptism, we go through that process of dying with him and being raised with him to a new life. And so there's a spiritual component that's symbolized here, but also the reality of our lives physically as we're willing to go through the difficulty. And so the idea of those who've suffered and died with Christ, then we've suffered in both of those ways, and we've died with Christ in those ways. We've been crucified with Christ, Paul says in Galatians chapter 2 and verse 20. If we died with him, we'll also live with him, Paul writes in 2 Timothy chapter 2 and verse 11. So we're not going to any longer live for the lusts of men, but for the will of God. And then Peter does us the favor of talking about some of the specific lusts and problems that we're not going to go back to. I mean, we've suffered. We suffered to get out of that. And we're not going to go back to that stuff. That's the point. Christ-like suffering we'll no longer engage in. And then he lists some things. And you look at, we've spent enough of our past lifetime doing the will of the Gentiles when we walked in lewdness or lasciviousness, as the King James Version says, the ESV says sensuality. So here's a problem like the world where everything has to do with sex in this world. I don't know if you've noticed that, but your cereal, your car, your whatever has to do with sex as far as the world is concerned. Everything is seen through that lens. We don't think that way. We don't live that way. That was the way of the world. We don't think that. That's lewdness. That's lascivious. That's sensuality. Lust, desire for that which is forbidden. That's what lust is typically in Scripture. Once in a while, it's used in a good sense, but the vast majority of the time, it's used lust for that which, desire for that which is forbidden. Then drunkenness, or as the King James Version says, excess of wine. Surely we understand what it means to be drunk. That's engages in that. They laud that. They live for that. They teach our young people to do it in college. You know, it's just part of, again, what's in the world. And then along with that, revelries, which are drinking parties or to indulge in revelry, Thayer says. Just a wild party, and again, the world's all about wild parties. And then drinking parties, as the King James Version says. The New King James says banqueting. And I just put here, these are occasions of social drinking. I get asked sometimes, do I believe social drinking is a sin? The answer to that is yes. And the reason I believe social drinking is a sin largely is because of this passage. The word that's translated banquetings there literally means social drinking. It doesn't necessarily refer to, you know, wild party or whatever. It's translated banquetings, and that's actually not a bad translation. I have a couple of references here. The Old Testament is written in Hebrew, but this Greek word that's translated banquetings here only occurs one time in the New Testament. But in the Greek translation of the Old Testament, the Septuagint, it occurs many times. So that gives us a lot better view of what it really means. You might remember that feast that Ahasuerus threw at the first in Esther chapter 1. Remember about that feast? And there was all kinds of wine and there was all kinds of drinking, but the drinking wasn't compulsory. Remember that? Every man could do what he wanted to do. That's what the text says. You know what that's called? Same word. It's social drinking. That's what it is. So, I mean, there's just not any doubt about it that the scriptures condemn social. There's lots of other arguments that we use and I use, but we don't have time for those today. But that's something that we need to impress on our children. It's something we need to impress on ourselves, probably. But it's not even a question as far as the Bible is concerned. I know people want to make it. Yeah, and that's a great point. These things are connected. The sexual connotation in the first couple, the lewdness and the lust, and then you have these drinking problems here going from, you know, horrible sort of parties just to the social acceptance of it. And then idolatries, and I note the plural there, because idolatry can be committed in multiple ways. Covetousness is idolatry, false religion's idolatry, setting up an idol is idolatry, but, you know, there's all kinds, anything you put, materialism can be idolatry. So anything you put ahead of God is idolatry. It's an interesting place for a plural word in that particular text. So those are all the things. We've suffered with Christ to be freed from those things, be forgiven from those things. Why in the world would we go back to those things? That's what the world is. That's not what we are. That's what the Gentiles do, as Peter said. We wouldn't go back to them. So let's go on. A Christian suffers because he continues to live the sanctified life. And if you look in verse 4, in regard to these, they think it strange that you do not run with them in the same flood of dissipation, speaking evil of you. So what does the world think of Christians when we won't do all this stuff? Well, we're the problem. You know, we're backwards. We're Victorian, of course. That's not what we are, but all this sort of stuff. We're accused of all of that. The world's going to think it strange that you don't join them in this same kind of stuff, and they'll speak evil of you. They may accuse you of thinking that you're better than everyone else. They may mock your faith, and they'll do all of that. And it doesn't matter if you're a young person or middle-aged or old, they'll do all of that. They do all of that. And what's Peter saying? That's just part of the suffering you get to go through as a Christian, to be like Christ. That's what he's saying. We don't get mad at that. That's your Christ-like. It's a privilege, and it should be worn as a badge of honor to suffer in this world at the hands of worldly people. I'm not going to compromise with them. We're not going to compromise. Let's take that suffering. They're going to give account of their behavior to the one who's going to judge the living and the dead, and that's all the more reason that the gospel needs to be preached to those who are dead, spiritually speaking. I think a really great text. As I said, we've got a lot of rich texts here we need to get through, but I think that text is powerful in a lot of ways and very practical. Yes, sir. No longer. Yep. Yeah. It's good. All right. Starting verse 7. The end of all things is at hand. Therefore, be serious and watchful in your prayers. Above all things, have fervent love for one another, for love covers a multitude of sins. Be hospitable to one another without grumbling. As each has received a gift, minister it to one another as good stewards of the manifold grace of God. If anyone speaks, let him speak as the oracles of God. If anyone ministers, let him do it as with the ability which God supplies, that in all things God may be glorified through Jesus Christ, to whom belong the glory and dominion and ever. Since the end of all things is at hand, we need to be watchful, vigilant, and prayerful. Now, I understand that it's been nearly 2,000 years since Peter wrote that. What does he mean, the end of all things is at hand? Well, the end of all things is the next expectation for humanity. There is the concept here of at hand can refer to point of time, but also it can be a point of place. And if you think of human history as kind of moving from one place with God to another place with God, we had what we used to call the patriarchal dispensation and the Mosaic, you know, and we're now, and then the next, what's the next thing after this? The dispensation of Christ. That's the end. So that's the next room, so to speak, that we're moving into. And I think that's how it's being used here. That's got to be our expectation. That's got to be our preparation then. So above all things, he said, the sanctified, and he's looking at us as those pilgrims who are sanctified, who are set apart. We're not part of this world. We're separate from it. Sanctified have fervent love for one another. To love one another is our prime directive. As I say often, it's the main thing we need to do above everything else, to love each other. Above all things, put on love, Paul said in Colossians 3:14. Jesus said it's with the first being to love God. So you have lots and lots of passages that teach this concept. So above all things, have fervent love for one another. Make it real. Make it intense. Fervent love is that intense love that is without ceasing. Love never fails. It burns brightly, continually. And love will cover a multitude of sin. Just a brief mention here. How does love cover a multitude? It covers a multitude of sins by pretending they don't exist. It covers a multitude of sins by covering them up and hiding them. It covers a multitude of sins by mercy and forgiveness, right? It's active. So in covering a multitude of sins, repeatedly in Scripture, this kind of phrasing is used to refer to forgiveness of sins. Sins are covered in that sense when they're forgiven. James 5, James talks about if you turn a sinner from the error of his ways, you'll save a soul from death and cover multitudes. I think it means the same thing there because it's just forgiveness, right? But notice especially this usage in Psalm 32, just one quick passage. David writes, "Blessed is he whose transgression is covered." Is he whose transgression is forgiven, whose sin is covered. It's forgiveness.
The other thing is the person who commits love.
Well, that's how he gets forgiveness. Yeah. So in that sense, and this is a continued result, is that there are going to be a lot of sins that aren't going to be committed because he's... So, think about that as well. But I think the core meaning of the idea of being covered, sins covered, has to do with forgiveness. The other thing we read in this passage is that the sanctified are going to use their gifts to serve. The gifts that we've been given are by the manifold grace of God. That phrase itself deserves a lot of attention that we don't have time to give it. But the manifold grace of God, God's grace is so multifaceted. There's millions of pieces to it, so to speak. We can't really even, but we have been recipients of some big parts of the manifold, the many-faceted grace of God. And we use the gifts then that he's given for what? Our pleasure, our personal. Jesus didn't do that. We're not going to do that. We're, again, set apart. So we use the gifts that we've been given. We show hospitality to one another without grumbling. If we have a home, if we have food, if we have something we can share, who gave it to? That's the grace of God. It's part of the grace of God. And so we'll share that. We'll use it for his glory. If we know God's word and we have the ability to speak, we're going to speak as the oracles of God. If we have the ability to serve, we're going to do it with the strength that God has supplied us. That's part of his grace. He's given us that strength to serve him. All of those things done to the glory of God. Done in all things. Again, very rich passage. Good thing. Comments on that before we go on or questions? All right. Everybody staying awake this morning? Good, because if you're too tired, I got a sermon for you next hour. Picking up in verse 12, gets back to this suffering and persecution. Specifically, do not think it strange concerning the fiery trial, which is to try you as though some strange thing happened to you. The sanctified are going to suffer for the glory of God. Don't think that's strange. That's normal. That's what we should see as typical as Christians. Rather than thinking that strange, this fiery trial, rejoice to the extent that you partake of Christ's suffering. See, here's the point. We're getting to suffer with Christ, be more like him, partakers more and more of who he is, what he was as a human being, and who he is regarding his divine nature. So that when his glory is revealed, we also will be glad with exceeding, because we're going to be like him. That's what John says, 1 John. You know, we're going to see him as he is. We're going to be like him. It's what we're struggling to be. And how he is he's somebody who suffered for others gladly, so that he, so we suffer for him, like him. And the word fiery trial, that's translated fiery trial, is a pretty interesting word, parousi, and it comes from the word that we get pyre, which is a where you burn somebody, and or pyromaniac. That's the Greek word for fire, basically. The fiery trial is not just trial that's under consideration there, but a fiery one. And as you may be aware, when Peter's writing this, Nero is on the throne, and he's literally putting Christians on stakes and lighting them. So that had particular meaning, no doubt, to them. Don't think that's strange. Count it a blessing to suffer reproach as Christ. Pick it up in verse 14. If you're reproached for the name of Christ, blessed are you, for the Spirit of glory and of God rests upon you. On their part he's blasphemed, on your part he's glorified. Let none of you suffer as a murderer, or a thief, an evildoer, as a busybody in other people's matters. If anyone suffers as a Christian, let him not be ashamed. Let him glorify God in this matter. For the time has come for judgment to begin at the house of God. And if it begins with us first, what will be the end of those who do not obey the gospel of God? Now, if the righteous one is scarcely saved, wherever the ungodly and sinner appear, therefore, let those who suffer according to the will of God commit their souls to him in doing good as to a faithful creator. The glories of suffering are, again, Christ-likeness. If anyone suffer as a Christian, may I say to you that the word Christian, the name Christian, is only used three times in the whole Bible. And it's more than coincidental that it's used in this chapter, where Peter is focused on suffering like Christ. And he calls us Christian. If you suffer as a Christian, one who is Christ-like. You see that? Again, that's the big overarching point, much that he has to say. So we're suffering, and people saying bad things against us, all of that. They're blaspheming Christ. But as we endure all of that, we're glorifying Christ by our endurance. Don't suffer for doing evil, you know, murder, thief, evildoer, busybody in other people's matters. You know those things. The murderer, nobody's going to be a murderer. Stealing, yeah, that's wrong. An evildoer, a busybody, we don't even put that in the same category, right? A lot of people suffer because they got their nose in other people's business, and then they want to talk about how persecuted they are, right? That's not suffering for Christ. So don't suffer in any of those ways or in any way of evil doing. Aspire to lead a quiet life, to mind your own business, Paul will say in 1 Thessalonians 4. And then, interesting and somewhat, I think, difficult text in a way, the sanctified who suffer are going to be vindicated at judgment. We understand that. At the judgment, it's all going to come clear. We'll get our reward if we're suffering for Christ. Those who cause the suffering will get their punishment on that day. And that's clearly delineated here at the end of the chapter. But he says the righteous are scarcely saved. And people looked at that and say, you mean God's grace just barely saves? I don't think that's the biblical concept. I think that God's grace overwhelmingly saves. So those two concepts are not in competition here. The idea of being scarcely saved is hardly, through hard time, through difficulty. And the difficulty and the hardness is the suffering that he's just talked about. In the context, that's got to be what he's talking about. The righteous are saved through the straight and narrow, through the difficult way, through the persecution, through the suffering, through the reproaches. We've got to go through all that if we're going to be saved, right? That's the point. And then if you're not going through any of that, and you're the ungodly, and you're the sinner, and you're the persecutor, where in the world are you going to stand at judgment? Yeah, not good. So that's kind of the questions or thoughts on that? Yeah, right. The context just bears it out, really. Right, commit exactly like him. We trust God through all of this, the suffering, but everything. Trust our souls to him. That's so Christ-like. Good points. Anything else? All right, let's get into chapter 5. The elders who are among you, Peter says, I exhort, who am a fellow elder and a witness of the sufferings of Christ, also a partaker of the glory that will be revealed. So Peter addresses them as a fellow elder. The idea of a witness of the sufferings of Christ probably refers to his apostleship as well, which he's already indicated. And he's a partaker of the glory that will be revealed. So he's part with them in what they're doing as shepherds. And he tells them something of their duties and their motivation. They're told to shepherd the flock which is among you, serving as overseers. Three highlighted words there. The word shepherd there is a verb. It's shepherding. It's what one does. Elders are actually only called shepherds in the noun form once in the New Testament, in 5:11. It's usually translated pastor. The other times the word shepherd is used in reference to the elders' work, it's a verb. It's they're doing. They're feeding, they're flocking, they're leading. Those kinds of that shepherds do. The shepherd is to, elder is to shepherd the flock which is among you, not somebody else's flock, the one that he's among or that's among him. And that means that shepherds don't have any authority in some other congregation. Then thirdly, they are overseers, episcopus, scope. We get the word scope from that. So the idea of scoping something out, you know, and the idea of fully around, scoping, epi is the prefix there, but you scope all around, you're an overseer. If you look at the lexicons on this, you'll get the word superintendent, somebody who's over the whole shebang and looking over everything, making sure everything is running, you know, the heads of businesses. They don't maybe do everything in the business, but they make sure that everything in the business is done, and they're looking over all of that in that school superintendent. Same kind of concept. But here you have multiple shepherds in a congregation all looking over the flock. They are serving willingly. They are serving eagerly. They are not motivated by material gain. Shepherd the flock of God, which is among you, serving as overseers, not by compulsion, but willingly, not for dishonest gain, but eagerly, nor as being lords over them entrusted to you, but examples to the flock. There's a not but construction there that I think deserves a little attention. It's not that elders are over the flock. He's not saying elders, you're not over the flock. He's not saying elders, you don't rule over the flock. Other passages, Paul writes clearly that elders who rule well are to be counted worthy of double honor. They are plainly over the flock in an authoritative position. But here's the focus for the elder. It's not that position of authority that he's focused on. It's his position of being an exemplary child of God before the flock. That's the focus. So it's the not this, but that he's focused. And I think a lot of people, you know, we've had a good disagreement among brethren about really how elders are to operate. Some of it based on this text, a misunderstanding of this text, that, well, they don't really have any decision-making power, or they're not really over. No, they are. They do. But they're not just examples, but that is the focus of how they should view their work. And I think that's really wonderful direction from the Spirit. So they're examples of the flock. If they do well, the chief shepherd will bring them a crown of glory. If you have shepherds, you have to have sheep, and the sheep need to be submissive. It's the work of sheep to be submissive. So chapter 5 and verse 5, likewise, you younger people, submit yourselves to your elders. I do not think here necessarily that elders here is referring to the office of an elder. I think this may be a bigger general principle, but the fact that it's tied in the context to the discussion of what elders are supposed to be doing, I think there's some implication there that those who are under elders, those who are younger and therefore under elders because of their age, the same principle would apply. There's a submission, respect, understanding your position that applies. So younger people, submit yourselves to your elders. And then he says, yes, all of you be submissive to one another and be clothed with humility. We should all, this is what Paul is in Philippians chapter 2, isn't it? Not looking out for our own interests, but also for the interests of others. Humble yourselves like Jesus humbled them. That's the point, Philippians 2, 3, and 4. So in that sense, the younger submit to the elders, but everybody submits to everybody. Now, you can't literally do that if somebody's in charge, but that's the attitude. That's the approach. We always put ourselves under. And the elders themselves. And you know, I've seen that multiple times, haven't you, over the years, where the elder will, you know, put himself in the position of humility, to serve one of the sheep as if he were under that sheep. So that's the beauty. So we're just all of us to be clothed with humility. Be clothed with humility, he says, because God resists the proud, but gives grace to the humble. In picking up in verse 6 then, therefore humble yourselves under the mighty hand of God that he may exalt you. Jesus, just over and over and over again, teaches in the Gospels, whoever exalts himself will be humbled, and he who humbles himself will be exalted. He says it over and over and over again, attaches it to multiple parables, multiple teachings that he does. And it's true. It's again said again here. If we humble ourselves, we'll be exalted by God in due time. Let God take care of the exaltation. Don't exalt yourself. And then he says, casting all your care upon him, for he cares for you. To me, the connection here, it takes humility to cast your cares on somebody else. What do you have to admit if you're saying some help here? That you can't do it yourself, right? So I've got this problem, I got this care, I have this concern. And to not give it to God is to say, oh, I can handle this myself. That's pride. And that's a huge problem with Christians because we think, you know, we can do it. We don't need God's help. Humility says, God, you take this. You take all of it, casting all your care upon him. So, it's not an optional sort of thing. It's not a suggestion here, casting all your care upon him. In Psalm 73 and verse 25, the psalmist says, whom have I in heaven but you? There's none upon the earth that I desire besides you. You know, God is it. We're relying on him. We're totally in his hand, and we need to appreciate our position. So be anxious for nothing, but in everything, by prayer and supplication with thanksgiving, in everything, let your requests be made known to God. Right. Yeah. Good observation. Anything else? All right. Look at verses 8 and 9 as sort of winding up this section. Be sober, vigilant. The devil talks about lions, resist him in the faith, knowing that the same sufferings are experienced by your brotherhood in the world. Notice that temptation and the efforts of Satan against us are described as suffering. Again, that's a way that we suffer. So sheep and shepherds, all of us, all of the sanctified, must be vigilant to resist the devil. The nature of Satan's threat just demands that. I mean, if you're a sheep and you've got a roaring lion, you better pay some attention. You ever watched, you know, the scenes of the animals on the Serengeti, and there's the lions just sitting there, and this antelope or whatever just kind of gets lackadaisical and just goes a little bit too close, and then that's it for the antelope, right? So that's you got to be watchful. You have to be aware at all times where that lion is, what he's doing, what he's trying, where he's lurking in your life. And so he's trying to devour men's souls. Satan must be resisted. Resist him steadfast in the faith. The word resist there is a word that is found also in James chapter 4 and verse 7 in a similar context, but it's translated in Ephesians 5 as, you know, we're to put on the whole armor of God that we may withstand against, stand against the devil. And the word stand there is that same word, resist, stand to fight. Concept, don't give in, resist him, steadfast in your faith, he said, because you know that the same sufferings are experienced by your brotherhood. Everybody goes through this. Nobody's unique as far as having to suffer. Sometimes the why me attitude, never be among us. Why me? Because I'm a Christian. That's why bad things happen. We're Christian like Christ. Let's resist the temptation. Feel sorry for ourselves. We're to rejoice. Yes. Yeah, that's exactly right. Exactly what it ends with. The text does with some God's grace for pilgrims. First of all, may the God of all grace, who called us to his eternal glory by Christ Jesus, after you've suffered a little while, perfect, establish, strengthen, and settle you. So again, after you've suffered a while, God's going to do something by his grace that's really going to be the word. That's translated perfect there is, I think, especially noteworthy. It means to mend, fix, or repair. Through our suffering and at the end of our suffering, we're fixed. You know, there are a lot of people who come to churches and they don't want you to try to fix them. They need to reevaluate. We all need fix. And God fixes us through suffering. That's part of the deal. That's how he helps us, perfects us, establishes, strengthens, and settles us. Then there are some closing salutations and observations. Silvanus, our faithful brother, as I consider him, by Silvanus, our faithful brothers, I consider him, I've written to you. So Silvanus, Silas, elsewhere called, is Paul's scribe here. By the way, he's also called a prophet, Silas is. He's one of the New Testament prophets. So you have a prophet, you know, pinning this for an apostle. That's pretty good. That's pretty good text right there. I think, interesting. So Mark is also there. Mark sends greetings, and just the fact that he sends greetings is interesting, but the fact you got Silas and Mark and Paul, Peter, in this group, sending this epistle. And then all are to greet one another. Greet one another with a kiss of love and peace, the will of God. So, important lessons. Those who suffer and die with Christ are not going to choose to go back to living in the world. Love one another. Use our God-given abilities to serve others and God. Expect to continue to endure suffering if we continue to live sanctified lives. In this way, we glorify God. Elders are to shepherd and oversee the flock, and the flock must submit to their leadership. And the devil is a deadly foe. We have to be vigilant and stand against him. And anything else real quick before we go? All right, I think we're going on to 2 Peter in the next class. So gear up for that. 2 Peter and Jude, as we know, are connected together, and we're going to connect them together in this study as well. So you might want to take the time to read those total four chapters together and see and notice that. All right, thanks.